Hi, this is Polly. This is our Thursday, July 21st evening call. At least it's evening in Southern California.
And I'm Josh here with my mom on the call.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. I was still trying to gather my wits about me here.
Right.
Sorry.
And I just want to let everyone know that the rules are everyone's muted. But if anybody has a question, you can just hit star 2 on your phone. That we see a little symbol that lets us know you have a question or a comment, and we can unmute you individually and talk to you and then put you back on mute. And we really encourage everyone to chime in. I know this group generally isn't terribly talkative, but we really are here to answer all your questions. So don't feel go for it. Give it a shot.
Go for it. Believe me, we all, Josh and I, know how awful it was back in the days, and so we didn't talk very much. It was hard enough.
What do you talk? Speak for yourself. I'm an extrovert at heart.
I know, but I was always chewing gum and trying to keep myself from throwing up and stuff like that, or racing to the bathroom. So we've got some more people that have joined, so if you have questions, then just star 2, and your hand will go up, and we'll talk to you. Otherwise, I have an entire couple of pages of questions from people. So until somebody's brave enough to talk with us, I will start on those questions. Let me see. Okay, Josh. I suffer from depression and anxiety attacks. My severe anxiety started in primary school. I can see watching my 10-year-old son. He is exactly like I was at that age. Oh, my goodness, that sounds familiar. What can I get for a very anxious 10-year-old? He struggles getting to school, saying he can't get through the day. Not every day, but at least 2 to 3 times a week. He also makes up that he is ill to avoid going. Boy, that sounds familiar. He has the occasional fallout with friends, but other than that, school is fine for him. He just can't pinpoint what the reason is. Oh, my. Boy, do I relate to this.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm essentially going I have the same child, more or less. This is a case you all don't know. We, in the Break Free program, really believe in a genetic element to this. And if we can, in all of our cases, and all the people I work with, we can look up in our family trees and see this. So, my biggest, feature, my biggest accomplishment perhaps, is the education that I've acquired when it comes to this disorder. And so I have 2 kids, a just turned 13-year-old yesterday daughter, and a 10-year-old son. And it's my son, actually, who struggled a little bit. And there's a few things. So I'll kind of answer this from my parental perspective. I let it be known that this was an okay subject to talk about. I didn't directly hide it, or we weren't ashamed of it. However, I still lived my life as normally as I could. For parents, this is an encouragement I would give to you to, even if you maybe don't have the courage for yourself, sometimes we can find that extra little bit of courage knowing that modeling good behavior as far as still living our lives, and learning yourself about anxiety can be that can give you the motivation to do that, and what you do there will directly translate to what your kids are able to accomplish. So when it has come up, which with my son has come up around restaurants, not very similar to the way I felt as a young man, and we're able to talk about it. We're able to talk about what it is, what it isn't. It's just chemistry. And I will play games about, sort of a minimized version of what I do with people when they're having panic attacks. He's not really having panic attacks. That's not true. He's actually had some minor, mild panic attacks, I would call them. And we, do the standard stuff where we know what it is, what it isn't, what it can't do, all that scary thinking that comes up. We address the catastrophic thinking, a little bit of distraction. Now, here's the part I'm hesitant to talk about because, medication has been necessary for myself, for a lot of people I work with. And when I see him really struggling, We've got an authorization to give him a small amount of, in this case, the benzodiazepine. And this, to me, reinforces the concept that we talk about it's just chemistry. And this thinking is a result of chemistry. So we do this little microscopic dose, and in about 25 minutes, right on cue, that thinking starts to break down, the chemistry starts to break down. And that's the route I'm choosing to go as a parent. I don't necessarily think that's necessary for every parent. Maybe not even the right technique for every parent. But that's the road that I'm going down.
I like to see that because if you start imprinting on fearful things, those tracks in your brain get deeper and deeper and deeper. And so you can work other times, but when you're in a crisis situation, it's really great to have something that you know is going to break it for the moment. You know, he's only got to suffer 25 minutes or so. You can stick it under your tongue. It tastes terrible, but you can make it go a little bit faster.
Not the one I have. You're saying some do, some don't. I've got
okay.
one that's not
okay.
That's not better. But, you know, there's a second element to that I wanted to mention. You know, he sees both my wife and I take the Breakthrough Nutrition stuff every night. And you know, sometimes when his anxiety is running a little high, he'll notice his sleep isn't as ideal. I mean, it's just a miniaturized version of the adults that I work with. There's really very little differences. And so all of a sudden he starts asking me, hey, can I take one of those? And this is so safe, easy stuff. I have no trouble handing the Breakthrough Nutrition over to my kid. And on his own, regularly, he takes it on with us at night before we go to bed, and his sleep improves, the episodes diminish. It is, again, just like my experience working with adults. He takes one-fourth the amount of the nutrients that I take, which is about right for our weight ratio.
Right.
And he takes a pill. He takes it, swallows it. He's amazing, actually, on that front. I think he can do a full-size pill without water. He's odd. Yeah, we have all
he's
these
kind of like
that
his dad who likes to experiment with everything. You know, on this subject, I kind of wanted to bring up how you work with some of your children because we do work with children,
uh-huh.
and we do adjust the dosage of all the nutrients according to their size. Some of them, it doesn't matter if they take more or not. But anyway, we do have the parents adjust, and it costs a lot less, you know, maybe 2 months, or you're saying 4 months for him because he's really nice and trim. But you talk about redefining what is scary. Let's see, how do you say it? You redefine what is hard and what is easy.
Oh, right.
That is a really important point to get across because when parents redefine it, their children feel so much better.
Yeah, and I think that naturally comes through the way I teach. Let me kind of explain. You're talking about, you've heard me use this phrasing before.
Right.
It's not something I just said. But, yeah, it's basically we're all born with a list. You know, football champion, whoever, Eli Manning, you know, he has a list, right? He obviously is very good at football. He still had to work at it, and his parents had a certain list. Maybe some things were difficult. I don't know what it was in his case. But with anxious parents or with anxious kids, our lists are different. The things...
L-I-S-T-S? List?
The list. The list of things that we're good at and the things that are hard for us.
Right.
Let's take your typical football star, right? You know, he might struggle with grades. He might... I don't want to be too stereotypical. But he might struggle with keeping his room clean or being respectful to his parents. We have a list. And most of us feel comfortable operating within a list that is familiar. And parents come to me and they say, you know, my kid does all these things. And often they actually are standouts in academics and sports. They're intelligent, attractive, capable, so all these things. And then they'll say, but riding the bus is so challenging. And my answer is, so what? That's the list. You know, we just switch things around. And maybe this kid of yours has no trouble getting straight A's, has no trouble maintaining a couple really solid friendships, lots of good things, but the bus is a challenge. The anxiety is an issue. And we try to treat it just like we would if they wanted to become, you know, become academically qualified for Stanford. You'd work on it. you'd learn about it, and you'd study, and you'd work on it, and you would reward it just like you would if your son was a good football player and learned new skills and got even better. I just want parents to say, your kid has these amazing traits. We tend to, when people call me, they tend to focus on the negative, the struggles, and I understand that's why they're calling me. But if we look at the whole child, there's huge areas where they thrive, where they're extraordinary, exceptional. Their list is just different. And I just want parents to kind of bend their head around that. It's just a different list. And we treat the challenges, you know, just because everyone else rides the bus pretty easily, that doesn't matter. This is your kid's list. Let's just, you know, and let's reward when they do well. Let's learn how to get better at that. It's a new skill set. The information is out there. Just attack it just like you would trying to make him a better quarterback, a better academic student. It's not that different. But we
I remember your story about Earl Campbell, about how he played football. And I don't know if are we too old for everybody, Earl Campbell?
Houston Oilers. He holds a bunch of records in a running back position. And he was a bit notorious for not running around you. He ran through you. And he was one of the toughest, most capable football players in the history of the NFL. I'm absolutely certain he's in the Hall of Fame by now. Yeah, for sure. And yet, he struggled massively with anxiety all through that. And I know how hard what he did is. Most people don't. And so I have more respect not for the yards he gained on the field, but for the fact that he still got to the field, got to practices, showed up, after-game interviews, all the stuff that I know how hard it is that he was still able to do. And he had a career. He mostly kept it a secret because that was a time when we really didn't talk openly about this. And, he's amazing. He's just a great example of, you know, he has all the toughness in the world. If we ever feel like it's a saying about our masculinity or our courage or something like that, he had all that stuff in spades. No problem with pain, pushing through injury.
Getting to the football field was hard for him.
I'm trying to talk generally about how devastating panic attacks were. I know with who's the Miami Dolphin player who had the dreadlocks, got kicked out for marijuana. Ricky Williams?
Yes.
Reggie Williams or Ricky?
Ricky.
Ricky Williams. He, his issue was interviews. And you would see him in post-game interviews. He would leave his helmet on, which looked really odd, but for him, he felt a little more shielded from public judgment. And in his case, kind of tragically, he kept using marijuana as a way of coping, and the NFL frowns upon that, and it stays in your bloodstream for a very long time, so it's testable for, up to about 30 days after use, and so he is no longer playing football, which tells us if he had a choice between years of celebrity status, multi-million dollar contracts set for life, versus feeling better, he chose to feel better.
Right.
And
he went into seclusion and went into all kinds of meditation. I never could get a hold of him. I tried to get a hold of him, and there was no way I could get through to him. But it just broke my heart that he could have gone back to. I felt strongly that he would have been fine and been able to go back and play if he'd just known what we do. Okay, next question.
All right. Anybody?
Come on, you guys. I'm going to call you wussies, but I can do that because because I was there. Oh, listen, it's teasing here. I'm allowed because of all the things that I couldn't do. Okay, I thought for so long I was alone in all this, but I'm not. At the same time, there are days I feel so alone and wish it was all over. That I go and read stuff on the page and it helps me. I just wish the people around me, family and friends, would try and understand how bad things really are and that I can't just get over it. Any advice that would help me explain to them would be great.
That's challenging. Trying to explain to somebody anything as powerful as anxiety if they haven't experienced it themselves is difficult. you know, as I just mentioned earlier, oftentimes this runs in families, and there, some families, it runs throughout them, but they still don't talk about it within the family. I don't know if that's the case here. I do run into the occasional person that they're kind of the outlier. They're the one person, and the rest of their family doesn't appear to struggle with this. So when I was trying to explain this to people, which is, again, this is always going to be challenging, there's a couple directions to go. One is to explain what waterboarding is. That sounds dramatic, but if you're really trying to communicate how hard this is, all waterboarding is, which unfortunately we got to learn about waterboarding through Dick Cheney and the whole torture thing that started at the Iraq War and Afghanistan War. Basically, if you induce a panic attack in a regular person, all you're doing is injecting them with the chemistry that we get naturally. And that will elevate their heart rate, that will get all the sweat and the symptoms that we're familiar with. But if someone is immune to those chemicals, as in they don't fall into a panic attack, the last feature you put in is you make them breathe excessive amounts of CO2. Perfectly safe to do. Our bodies feel, we don't actually have the ability to perceive oxygen. We have the ability to perceive CO2, and that sense we get that we need to breathe comes from excessive amounts of CO2. So you give somebody a bunch of CO2, and plus with these three chemicals, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol, or you'll hear me say epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol. Those are just two different ways of saying the same chemicals. Whammo, you can take a regular person who's not susceptible to panic attacks, and you can allow them to fully experience. They'll report it as kind of like drowning, you know, on dry land, dying in place, verbiage that you guys might be familiar with. And if you want to look at a cheap way of inducing that, you just put a rag on someone's head and saturate it with water while they're tied down, and you have waterboarding, which induces all the stress hormones that we're talking about and induces the excessive CO2 by not allowing them to get a full breath of air. They're not at any grave danger as far as actual hypoxia. It's possible you could overdo it and they'd pass out, but generally speaking, they're fine, but they feel like they're drowning. And there is water all over their face, and they're unable to feel like they're getting a full breath through these water-soaked towels. I don't know how many centuries this technique has been around for, so the short answer is, the closest thing to a panic attack is the worst form of torture that the United States uses or that we use to interrogate ISIS or Al-Qaeda or all that. And sometimes that gets through to people. When I was younger and less educated about what a panic attack is, I would talk about a lot of people can relate to claustrophobia. And I would talk about, you know, imagine you're kind of buried alive. Just kind of feel that for a moment, what it would be like to be in a coffin underground, you know, no chance of getting out. And for me, sometimes social situations or certain places I put myself in, I feel just as trapped. I feel the same feeling that you would feel. As paradoxical as it sounds, even though those situations I actually do have the freedom to leave, I feel just as trapped. I don't give myself that permission to leave, and I feel just as trapped. I feel the same extreme emotions that would come from being buried alive. So those are two basic ways that I've tried to use to communicate
to
people.
Well, when I talk to people, I ask them what is their most fearful thing, the partner, let's say. And then they describe what is the most frightening thing for them. And one of the ones that is in the audio course, this man told me that his worst fear was being in the middle of the ocean and it's dark and he's treading water and there's no land in sight. You know, sharks are there. He
right.
knows he's going to drown. It, you know, there's no hope. And I said, okay, you need to know that every time you ask your partner to go to Hawaii or go out to dinner or whatever it is, that's what it feels like. And that's what you're sending her to. And sometimes that gets through. Sometimes that they can relate, but it's very, very difficult unless you've really been there to understand.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word that's what you're sending her to. I would say that's the feeling you're asking her to challenge.
Okay.
That's the courage that you're asking her to have.
Right.
And there's no, by the way, we can't absolutely learn to do all these things without those feelings. I would actually add, when I explain that to someone, that, you know, now imagine feeling that center of the ocean, dying in the middle of the night feeling, except there is no ocean, which is oddly kind of worse. You can't really figure out why this is happening. There isn't an ocean. There isn't a shark. There isn't anything. It's just happening to you. Your brain kind of starts racing, trying to figure out what could be the cause of these extraordinarily difficult feelings. But, yeah, they're right on par. I've been in situations where life was going really bad and death was very possible, and I do just fine. I actually find them easier than most people because of the experiences I've had with anxiety. So, yeah, it's tough to explain to other people. That being said, you don't have to communicate fully to everyone to live your life, to begin your recovery, to feel well. Ultimately, you need to be able to say, this is a real thing. This is what I struggle with. I don't necessarily need you to understand, but I just need you to know that it's there. It's an issue. If I bring it up, you'll know what I'm talking about. I think people could recover without, you know, their family in this case, absolutely knowing what a panic attack is like. I just, you know, if I communicate to people that I have this and they don't understand, I just say, look, here's the things it brings up. Here's what I, you know, might need to do if not that it will, but if something goes odd today and I need to take a break, here's why. And as long as I have as long as I have the strength to say, and I'm going to stick to that. And if you tell me, oh, no, come on, doesn't matter how you feel, we got to push through, whatever, but that's just not going to fly. You wouldn't, if you knew what I was experiencing, you wouldn't ask that question. So, or you wouldn't make that request. And so as long as
maybe
I have the strength.
This person might be hoping they understand, kind of thinking that that would make them better. And the reality is it's inside of them, and that's what we have to deal with.
The biggest improvement, maybe the biggest single improvement that comes initially from a cognitive point of view, is taking the shame out of it and saying, this is what I have, this is what it is, I know what it is, you know what it is. The hiding element we pay a huge toll. And just about everyone who initially struggles with this does some form of hiding. And the ability to kind of take off that big, huge weight on your back and just be able to speak freely about it is one of the most critical initial phases of recovery. Doesn't mean that it solves all your problems, but if you're still carrying around that particular weight, a feeling like you need to be ashamed of this and hide this and keep it a secret, please take that off. Share with people as needed. You don't need to tell them everything, but take that particular load off. What I find is about half the people have experienced it personally in some form at some point in their life. And about, let's see, that half plus the next 25% maybe, know somebody, love somebody who struggles with it. And then the next 10% or so will tell me something just as difficult that they're struggling with. Could be cancer, infidelity, drug abuse. It's funny, when I begin sharing openly with people, I've got to be prepared to learn more than I maybe wanted to back the other direction. And, yeah, there are a few people that just won't cop to anything. I don't tend to believe them, but they tend to be like, nope, life is great. Don't know what you're talking about. I have no problems. Those are few and far between. Or those worst-case things we might imagine, how somebody might view us as crazy, needing to be institutionalized, not being safe, not feeling safe around us, whatever our particular fears might be around sharing openly with people. Very, very, very rarely do those realities come true. 99.9% of the time, it's going to turn out very different than that. And in most cases, it's positive.
Yeah, I had to learn. That was my first assignment in one of the classes that I took, was to go out and tell people. And I think it did lift a huge amount off of me, because let's suppose I'm sitting in the theater and I don't want to get up, or I don't want to leave, and I don't want to make somebody upset. Mm-hmm. If I just say right off the bat, well, I might have to get up and go to the bathroom or something, I have anxiety disorder, blah, you know, something, or on the airplane.
Sure.
I just tell people, oh, if I get up and I wander around, if I sigh a lot or, you know, this is why. And most everybody's wonderful about it. As a matter of fact, I did that one time with one guy. It turned out he was terrified to be on the airplane. And he talked to me all the way home. He was just he was so happy he didn't rent the car. He was going to drive for hours and hours and hours because he didn't want to get on that plane. And we touched down in like less than an hour, and he was just a happy boy after that. Okay, let's go to another question.
Hold on. You hit on something that I want to talk about just really briefly. I was at a sailplane competition, and I had the opportunity to go race a glider with another guy that I didn't know. And I think many of you can understand the idea of getting in a very small cockpit with two people, one who you don't know for, we were looking at about 3.5 hours of racing up in the air, might be a little unnerving. And he happened to be a doctor.
More than that.
And so and by the way, sailplanes, you know, we circle a lot. You know, we find the most turbulent updrafts in the bay, and we might do 20 or 40 circles, pulling more than 1G. So you actually feel that high G load buried in your seat. It's, even for a normal person, it's pretty nauseating.
I can't even turn around without getting nauseous.
Right. So we might do 30 circles as we climb from 5,000 feet to 17,000 feet. We're wearing oxygen. And I'm just thinking, do I want to do this? And I thought, well, it depends. If I trust the guy, he's a doctor. And I talked to him, and he gave me one of the worst responses. As far as like that feel I get, as far as being understanding, compassionate, not at all. And it occurred to me that people who end up being doctors are probably the last people who would understand anxiety disorders. If you look at the kind of filtration process
filtering
that goes through to be a doctor, including those fun things like being forced to stay up 36 hours, 48 hours at a time, it's as if they have specifically weeded out people who have anxiety disorder. It would be rare to find somebody in the medical field who really understands. They exist, but they're unusual. And I just point this out because I don't expect doctors, especially your general practitioner, your standard internal medicine doctor, to be able to really understand the nuances of anxiety disorder. So they're kind of, unfortunately, some of your worst advocates is your typical doctor. They just aren't going to get it at the level that we do. I noticed that we have a hand raised.
Yes,
so
I was going to say, we have a brave person from Connecticut. Oh, and a dog.
So, your name comes up as Sonia on my computer, is that right?
Yes, correct.
Sonia.
How are you?
Fire away.
Well, I just started having anxiety and depression about almost 3 years ago. I was around 38 years old. And my doctor did a neurotransmitter test about a year and a half ago. My GABA was really low. Then she gave me all these supplements, GABA and taurine. So she took it again. I just had it again, and my GABA, it went up a little. But I still feel like a lot of anxiety. My depression is gone, but my anxiety is still there. How effective is the neurotransmitter testing? Have you had any good outcome?
So just in case your dog starts barking, I'm going to mute you just while I give you an answer, and then I'll unmute you, and you can talk tomorrow, okay? Neurotransmitter tests, I see them come up. I haven't seen them work terribly well. The types of interventions that you're talking about sort of like make sense on paper. If we feel like we're testing low for serotonin, you know, we have all these wonderful things like SAMe, L-tryptophan, all these serotonin precursors that we can take. In the case of GABA, you can take that. I've tried that in my personal life, and I haven't seen it work. And I don't recall a client that got a test, took those kinds of nutraceuticals is one way to kind of talk about that world. These ideas of taking chemicals that are very close to the ones that we maybe would get through a prescription or the exact copies. So it's complicated depending on which neurotransmitter we're talking about. But the short answer is, no, I haven't seen that system work very well. It sounds great. the idea of I take a test, I see what I'm low in, I see it, you know, I take the in this case, GABA, that I see my GABA levels rise. Your story is pretty typical. In my case, I actually thought I saw a little additional anxiety. It didn't only not help, it kind of hurt a little bit. The brain's a really complicated thing. Simply saying, oh, I've measured this chemical over here and I'm going to raise that one chemical and hope and that, you know, we get the results we want, I think is a little simplistic. The brain is this big, complex, interacting circuit that we sometimes intervene in counterintuitive ways. The classic example is using amphetamines for attention deficit disorder. We don't exactly know why that works, but we intervene in one part and then the rest of the brain kind of shifts and we get the results that we want. Unfortunately, it sounds like a beautiful model, but I haven't seen it work.
Dr. Myers used to say that there really was no test for anxiety disorder. That was what was so frustrating for people, is that there really just isn't any test. Now, there are adrenal insufficiency tests, because if we go long enough, we will wear out our adrenals. But we have to be very careful when we give the nutraceuticals for the adrenals, too, because we're very sensitive, and we have to monitor them very carefully to build up the adrenals. That's not how we work with our patients. It's a totally different approach than a single, like, build up the serotonin or GABA or anything like that. We're looking for replacing, well, actually, she talked about depletion. We're looking for the nutrients that have been depleted by the chemistry, and they're just nutrients, and it seems to make things work better. We are seeing more and more studies as to why they are working. I just saw two articles come through, one in Psychology Today and another one in, maybe it was the Huffington Report, was about probiotics. We use probiotics, but we use only two because we found through all of Dr. Meyer's history with patients that there are some probiotics that we sensitive people will react to. And so we just use two to seed the others, and these don't seem to cause a problem. So, but I have not seen anybody get any benefit from the GABA either. So,
okay.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. And I do try the gluten, because I'm a gluten-free, dairy-free. And that I've seen some improvements. And I noticed that when I do have gluten, I get more anxious. So I guess gluten, I'm sensitive to it.
Yeah,
well, my husband used to have a theory about that. He said when he first started practice, which was 1980, let's say, that's not the pre, but that's into his practice, he saw no one with gluten intolerance, which he found very interesting, that all of a sudden we have everybody in the world is gluten intolerant. And he had a theory, but that was not proven before he died, that he thought that it was possibly the genetically modified seeds that were causing this problem, because there are some that actually blow up the gut of the bug or the insect that's eating the food. They say it doesn't affect human beings, but he said he wasn't so sure that that was true. Anyway, he never saw gluten intolerance except for, like, celiac disease and such like that back in those days. But now all of a sudden we're seeing it everywhere. Whether it really helps or not to stay off of it, I don't know. Milk, on the other hand, Dr. Myers was really opposed to milk for most people because they lose their ability to digest milk. Some start very early and some late in life. We had a 96-year-old man that came in, and he was drinking a gallon of milk a day. And he was strong as a horse, and he could still drink it, but I have suddenly become unable to digest milk. So that one may definitely give you some problems. Nature didn't intend us to be drinking cow's milk, so
mm-hmm.
that could. But
yeah.
But the gluten, dang, that's really thrown my husband for a loop because of the fact that it wasn't there before. So,
my personal take on that is, I'm undecided on the gluten thing. I've tried it in my own life, and I didn't see much benefit. I certainly think it's a real thing for celiac disease. But if you watch what happens with your diet, if you strip out gluten, you're stripping out mostly simple carbohydrates, white bread, tortillas, some things that really don't have a lot of protein or lasting blood sugar regulation. And you'll tend to fill those calories with different calories. Hopefully you're not eating, candy bars. Hopefully you're eating meat, nuts, things with higher protein and fat. And if you do that, you should feel better. Regulating blood sugar is huge in this recovery process. And generally, when we cut down on simple carbohydrates, which aren't that far from sugar, they're just a little bit more complicated than sugars. Our bodies quickly break them down into sugars. We will tend to eat foods that are slower to break down and will keep us more level throughout the day with our blood sugar. So that would be an effect that I'd be looking for in your case.
Thank you. Now, Josh, have you seen women maybe under late 30s going through anxiety? Because I'm thinking maybe it's because I'm 41, premenopause. Could that be the reason?
There are some hormonal changes. The biggest block, so anxiety tends to hit in a few different groups. The biggest group is the early 20s. We're not quite sure why. There's definitely some hormonal shifts happening as our bodies kind of finish that growing phase. There's also some cognitive issues. We're moving out of our house, maybe getting our first job, maybe facing some really significant stressors. We often see it correlated with a traumatic event of some kind, something like a car crash or a burn or something that kind of is that final straw. So early 20s. And then I see about equal measure of late 30s, early 40s, and young kids. I was in the young kids category. But no, your category that you're in isn't all that uncommon. I talk to plenty of people like you. And I all I can say is I don't know why. I can say please be appreciative that you made it this far without having to struggle with it. And I applaud you for getting on it early. It's been 3 years. I know those 3 years were probably difficult. But that's actually pretty early in the process to be getting to us and really getting the help you need. So it's relatively easy to undo for people who start late in life and who get on it quickly like you do. So I'd be all very optimistic about where you're going. When you find just a few things that work well for you, I think you'll turn a corner pretty quickly.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Else that's brave, let us know.
Sorry,
okay.
Mom, I accidentally cut your mic off for just a second. STAR 2 is always available. There was an element in that last call that I kind of wanted to touch on, and it touches on somebody who's listening who wanted to know, what makes us different, what makes the Breakthrough Program different, perhaps what makes me different. And what I'm hoping you're picking up on is we aren't selling some magic, brand new, unthought of thing. We're selling something that's just years and years of narrowing down on the exact right thing to take. We don't play with the nutraceuticals much, certainly nothing in the Breakthrough Program. So you won't be taking things like GABA or any of the herbal remedies. That's just not what we do. We kind of come from a core belief that says this is a genetic disorder that is difficult but fixable. Then there's many things that we can, the outside of the Breakthrough Program that will work, whether that's medication, whether that's cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT. There's a lot of things that we know work. However, for those of us who reach kind of this point, who are reaching out, who find me, who find the Breakthrough Program, we're people who have struggled usually chronically. What my dad was so brilliant in figuring out, and my mom as well, is that there's a depletion process that occurs with chronic anxiety. And that can be having regular panic attacks, or that can be having generalized anxiety. And there's this downhill trend that will occur that he was able to solve. What is happening? What specific nutrients are being forced out of the body and how do we replace them? And it's not rocket science. It's very straightforward. If you learn the tools, the trips, the tricks, the tips that I have, this is not a silver bullet. This is undoing all that damage, turning that corner, giving your body back just what it needs in a very safe, zero side effects kind of way. And then we get to working. And if you come into this with a background where you've really experienced a lot of therapy but found it ineffective, you've tried all these things, meditation, exercise, all this stuff, what's so fun about my job is that all those now with the help of the Breakthrough Program, those things start working again. There is good information. People who come often with this string of things they've tried and it hasn't been effective, what would be a good analogy? For somebody with asthma or, let's say, diabetes, they've learned about diet. They've tried exercise. They've tried modifying their diets in an extreme way, and it just wasn't working. And you say, well, look, this is a genetic thing. You know, if you give them that insight, this is a genetic thing. There's this insulin you lack. If you don't know about insulin and you don't know about how to put it back in your body, this natural chemical that you would normally produce, all of a sudden you put that back in place, and then all those things that they had been trying will work like crazy, and their lives can get turned around. It's a very similar process. What's different about me is I kind of sit in the middle. I'm an advocate for each person I work with. I know about all the drugs. I know how to talk about them. I know what they do, what they can't do. Some of that's through personal experience. Some of that's through book learning. Some of that's through working with people and learning over my, 13 years of doing this, what works, what doesn't. I am an advocate that sits kind of squarely in the middle between psychology, psychiatry, standard medicine, the nutritional aspect, and so I'm able to branch out when I listen to people and pull tools from this huge library that I've acquired and make these kind of customized packages for each person. So I hope that I know someone had a question about what is different about this, and it's kind of nothing, in the sense that there's no magic here. There's nothing you have never heard of before, but we found that when you combine the right, in this case, nutrients in the right way at the right time.
Well, and body system balancing, there's a lot of that. Yeah. Like we were talking about blood sugar. That's absolutely critical for us. So we have to teach them a lot of that and snacking and just all kinds of little tips. It's silly little things you think, oh, that's nothing. But you add them all together and you just hit the right thing for the person that they need. And that's, so the whole program has a lot of pieces to it. Although it's not hard.
I'm the ultimate case of understanding why. We don't believe in this multi-pronged approach, these many small things that add up to huge change. When you're experiencing anxiety, it has this catastrophic nature to it. Every time you experience it, it feels as though you're dying. Extreme, the language you tend to use in your brain. And so someone comes to you and talks about blood sugar, talks about hydration, talks about some basic nutritional changes. It's like, no, that's not it. I don't know what the solution is, but it's going to look big and massive. It's going to be a drug, a powerful drug or something, and we're just so, and I speak from personal experience, we think there's the silver bullet out there, and that's not the case. And we can come so close to the solution, so frustratingly close to the solution. Sometimes I'll talk about things and people know, I've tried that. And I say, well, let's just look at that. How did you try it? And I tweak it a little bit, the time of day, the amount, whatever, just. And all of a sudden, it goes from being hardly effective to very effective. And that's just knowledge. The only thing that keeps me today from not being back where I was is the knowledge I possess. I'm the same person. I'm the same body. I have the same genes. I'm just as prone to going back into generalized anxiety. I have tools, and I have knowledge now. And I still have setbacks, in case you're wondering. I live an extraordinary life. But I still have setbacks and bad days, and I know how to undo them. And it's just information, and I am hoping to share that information with as many people as possible.
I wanted to mention to Sonia, I hope I said her name correctly.
Yes, Sonia.
There's a study called epigenetics, It's becoming more popular.
Getting complicated. We're getting deep. Yes,
I know. We're going deep. But I believe it explains why some people take so long before it shows. My brother was 60 before he tipped over the edge. And this is a young boy. Well, when he was a young man, he hitchhiked across the United States and Europe. He slept in who knows where, didn't speak the language, didn't eat all the time, just did all these crazy things with different people he met on the road and girls. And just, you know, I mean, you just throw the book at it of all the crazy things that you can do. Nothing happened. He goes through his life. He goes through some issues. He does use some drugs, which throws things off. And then he gets to a point in his life where he has a severe emotional and financial long-term series of things happening. And he tips over. And let me tell you, he went to the bottom. And he's been coming out. And he's doing much better. But it was 60 years old. And I think if we look at epigenetics, he had the genes, and they finally expressed themselves. So in epigenetics, am I correct, Josh? The gene doesn't express itself except under certain conditions?
So there's a few ways of thinking about it. It's tough in genetics, right? This is very cutting-edge stuff. I always try to find ways of explaining things that can make sense to everyone, right? And so you have this gene, these long strings of just four letters, amazingly, that create these extremely complicated blueprints, of which, my mom's right, most aren't read. For a gene, a section to be read, there's a little start code and a stop code. And then there's all these, and this is, I think, where the epigenetics component comes in. There's these other chemicals that are kind of doing the reading and doing the replicating. It's a pretty complicated process. The way I try to explain it is that you have a set of blueprints, and then you have a factory that was built off those blueprints, and you have workers who were built off those blueprints, and they're all interacting in this very complicated way. And there's an environment outside the factory. This is this constant flow between the outside environment into the factory, through the workers, back to the blueprints, getting the new. Workers built, getting the new factory elements built. It's a very complicated and flowing process. And it turns out the blueprints aren't the only part of the story as to how things happen. You can have workers get tired. They can start misreading the document. They can start looking at different sections on the blueprints and copying it incorrectly. There's a lot of things that can happen there. And, again, this is a little too new as far as studies to really talk in great detail about what we know about it. But I can say that more than just the genes if you just think it's just blueprints and that's all we are, that's an oversimplification. There are errors that can occur all throughout that process. Again, environment, the workers, quote unquote, the cells in your body, the sections within your cells that are looking and copying proteins off these genes. Errors can start to occur in anywhere in there. And it's not necessarily an error in the just flat out wrong sense. We are designed so that in varying environments, our body can express itself differently. And one of the most classic examples, which is probably an epigenetic phenomenon, is if you take a child and this has happened where they're raised in the wild, literally that it has happened, where a kid wandered off into the woods at 18 months and somehow ate fruit and pulled it off. There's a number of cases where this has happened. They look very different. They grow hair. It is thicker, longer, all over their body because they sleep in cold conditions. And so there's this interaction between the environment and their genes. And they're forever altered when they're adults and we find them or teenagers. There's no getting them back. Their brains develop differently. Their bodies are differently. Their capacity to understand language just didn't happen. It wasn't expressed in their brain. So these are called feral children. And they're kind of interesting. They're sad, but they're kind of interesting. And epigenetics definitely plays a role. Our body can do a lot of amazing things depending on what the environment asks it to do. And that's really not what we were taught when we learned about genetics. So Enough environmental factors.
So getting back to the basics, usually we see, this is real simplified, usually we see some kind of emotional or physical trauma, something that you may not even realize is happening. Like for Josh, he had immature digestion from the time he was born. And he could not digest his food properly for the first 2 years of his life. So by the time he was 4 or 5, he'd already tipped over into a panic attack. I had a severe trauma. I was in a hospital a year with very traumatic events when I was 7. I tipped over then, although I did have signs prior to that, my mother said. My father was in his teens when he started dating. For him, he had a very, very bad home life. But it was dating that was so stressful for him that he tipped over then. My brother is at 60 when it was financial and emotional. And I don't think he was eating very well, but just because he was so upset. So there usually basically is something that comes before the big tip over anyway. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah, and generally speaking, when I run into people who didn't get it until much later in life, I would say they're not terribly genetically predisposed. We can usually look back in the years or months prior to their first episode with anxiety, and we can kind of see what tips them over the edge. Generally speaking, I'm optimistic when I meet these people because I'm like, okay, you know, you're relatively low on the genetic predisposition. We have a few years of habits to undo. We have some, you know, basic daily lifestyle stuff we're going to tweak on and get your body built back up. And usually we can turn that corner relatively quickly. When I meet somebody who's had it since they were 5 or 7 and they aren't working on it until they're 35 after their fourth major episode with it, it's going to be a little bit longer. There's other advantages to having that much life experience with anxiety that helps the process along, but they've definitely beat themselves up for a lot longer, and it's going to just take a little longer to turn their bodies and brains around.
But we have had somebody 50 years locked in their house, so
it
can turn around even at that extent.
We're
down to 7 minutes for the call, so I hope anybody out there who wants to ask any question will raise their hand. Otherwise, I will go and we will keep looking to see if you have any questions, and we'll go to one more question. Hi, I'm 26 years old, and I have been dealing with pretty severe anxiety for the last 4 years. I try to hide it and pretend like it's not there, but lately it has gotten so bad that I feel like I'm going to lose it. I feel alone. My husband is trying to understand, but I don't think he really gets it. I'm constantly overthinking things, worrying about things I can't control. I will be sitting on the couch completely fine, and a commercial for a creepy TV show will come on, and I go into an immediate panic attack where my heart is pounding through my head. I need to get through this. I feel like every morning when I wake up, I am destined to have a panic attack. I just need support. I need someone to understand what I am going through. Well, I think she's incorrect. That's not just what she needs. But, Josh?
All right, so this is kind of the version of what I was talking about. This is the very typical story. It's slightly more common in women than men. The statistics say it's a lot more common with women than men. I just think that's a reporting error. The people I work with are, I would say, 50-50. But a young woman, early 20s, married life, you know, there's complexity with marriage. You know, this is your typical story. Is there some hormonal stuff shifting as we stop growing? Yeah, I think as well. Okay, this is somebody who sounds like they're struggling with some generalized anxiety and panic attacks, and this is all surprisingly fixable. This, you know, she's identified these moments where, a creepy show comes on or something, or an advertisement that just kind of sets her off. That tells me how depleted she's become. I always describe it like a shock absorber that has no oil or gas left in it, a battery that has no charge left in it. When it takes such a little thing like that to set you off, that we can fix. And so if this person can just imagine their generalized anxiety, whatever, let's call it a 6 on the 1 to 10 scale, if you can imagine, and this is what we can do just with the nutrition, forget all the stuff I can teach, This is just with a break free program. Let's say we get that 6 down to a 2. So you wake up in the morning, instead of a 6, you're a 2 all day. You got a better night's sleep, and you're actually feeling like your batteries are sort of recharging. I promise you that when you now face those things, whether that's the TV show or the other stuff that sets you off, you now have a buffer built up. And then all sort of my skill set shows up as far as how do we use that time to change the way we think, to change the way we act, change our approach to anxiety. But the huge benefit I have working with the Breakthrough Program is that that's the benefit I get. And it might mean the difference between an instantaneous response and 40 seconds. And that might not sound like a lot, but in that 40 seconds, you can have dozens of thoughts. You can watch them happen. You can change the direction of your thinking, and you can start to realize that I don't have to have panic attacks. But when you're so depleted that a small bump in the road causes not only that anxiety, but then the follow-on anxiety, kind of this echoing effect, it's similar to a shock that has no gas or oil. You hit that one bump. You experience the bump dramatically, and then as you go down the road, long after the bump, the car is still rocking up and down. It's exactly what it's like when our bodies feel depleted, when we really just don't have those reserves built up. If I were
a lot of us
person,
get really skinny, you'll notice. Yep. Although there's certainly some heavy people, but I find that the heavy people tend to be eating junk food. They'll be sipping on a Coke all day, or candy bars, or refined carbohydrates, because it gives us a quick boost, a mood boost. And so they'll eat and eat till they get too heavy. But generally, most of us are pretty thin when we're really struggling. At least that's what I've seen.
Yeah, I would agree. Generally, the people split into two directions. I would say about 75% of us go to the kind of underweight side, and a few of us stay close, and then maybe 10% go to the very overweight side. There's a few reasons for that. You're right, the quick boost, dopamine, can serve as a depression. Just the food-induced dopamine can help with some of the depression temporarily. When we get depleted with anxiety, we run out of glycogen, which is this kind of, I would think of it like honey. It's like a close to glucose sort of version that sits mostly in our liver, but actually sits in our muscles as well. It's what we use when we need that sort of stored energy to run away from the bear or to escape something. It's always sitting. We actually carry these reserves. So when we go through anxiety, we burn through those reserves. One of the first things your body asks for is, hey, can I have my sugar back? And I remember when I really struggled, I would get these sweet tooths that were pretty powerful about, 10 hours, 6 hours after anxiety, maybe the next day. My body would say, hey, let me rebuild that glycogen again. And I remember that feeling very distinctly. So, yeah, the weight thing. I know in your case, Mom, you got extremely light. That was true in my case. I lost about, 30%, 40% of my total body weight. I'd have to do the math, but it was
60 pounds, a lot of weight. I weighed 87 pounds when I got married, and they canceled the wedding. So it's when I got married at all. But
And for me, I became courageous enough to reach out for help when I felt like I was going to need to be hospitalized just for the weight loss. I was at a point where I needed to get IV and that kind of stuff.
You were able to talk about it too. That was helpful.
I have a lot of advantages over the average.
Pardon?
I have a huge amount of advantages that other people didn't get growing up in this particular family. Yeah, I got the genetics, but I also got parents who figured out a huge piece to this puzzle. And I got to use that piece, and then I added my own pieces with my own education. And, I feel really privileged to have the knowledge that I have. If I grew up in rural India and just never had access to the medicine, and there was cultural judgment around it, that would be hard. I would be living a very different life.
Or I'm not living at all. There's a lot of suicides. Yeah.
That's possible. You're always so dark, Mom. Do you know that?
I'm sorry.
You have a dark thread that runs through you.
Well, I've seen a lot of these people and gotten the calls in the middle of the night, and that's what I
do too. I do too. I just remain optimistic. This is a a horrible disorder that is completely fixable. That is my daily mantra, that this, yes, it sucks.
But
we
put
have
me
enough
in India
tools.
And I started imagining all these things because, you know, we have this wonderful imagination that just goes right down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, so, fight that.
Yeah.
Fight
okay,
that.
It is 6 o'clock. Do you have something to say?
I just want to close on that idea that this is fixable. There's a lot of disorders that I work with because they run in parallel with anxiety. Bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and so sometimes anxiety comes along for the ride. And I'm very, even within those disorders, I'm always surprised how effectively we can reduce the anxiety. I can't fix. We don't know enough yet about schizophrenia, autism, and the autism spectrum disorders, Asperger's, things like that. I can work with those people, those beautiful kids, but I can't fix them. I can take the anxiety out of their life largely, but I can't fix the underlying disorder. However, with anxiety, we can. And I'm not promising, you know, 100% never feel anxious again. I'm promising the ability to get back to whatever life you want to go towards. Want to climb Mount Everest? We'll get you there. Fly on an airplane for a living? Get you there. Pretty much what I do. So, yeah, this is a disorder that is incredibly difficult, but as hopefully people are realizing on this phone call, it's incredibly common. And we do, I think with the Breakthrough Program, we have, I'm assuming there's more pieces to the puzzle that we'll figure out in time, but with this last piece, we have all the pieces we need for anybody who struggles to get to where they want to go. That's a big promise, I know, and I know we've got people on the call that really struggle and who may just think that's the most outlandish thing they've heard. But it's a comment that I will absolutely stick behind. Just a matter of trying different things, finding what works for you. And there are tools within both me and the Breakthrough Program that you have not heard before. There are things, or you have not heard them in the right way. You haven't heard them in the right context. And with enough tweaking, we find a program for everyone. Okay, I'll stop there.
I love my job.
Yes.
It's hard to hear, but then the endings are really great. So it's worth it's worth all the work. Okay, everybody, this is the end of the call. Nobody raised their hand and had a question, so we're going to hang up, and you guys can email me if you have any questions or Facebook me, or you can let me know that you want to email Josh, because I don't think it's listed anywhere, and you can talk to him. So I'm going to say goodbye, and we will see you the first Thursday of next month. Bye.
Bye, everyone. I've actually opened up everyone's mics if anyone wants to say goodbye or has any final comments. Everyone's open right now.
I'm gonna hang up. I'm gonna stop the recording, and then if anybody wants to talk, then they can talk. And no.